Says the Buddha, he who is in continuous hell never dies. Longevity is a big hardship in continuous hell.
Previews of coming attractions.
Coming out this week, a lot more movies than last week. Last week there was only one that I could find that was coming out for that weekend. This week it's something like four or five, plus a bunch of limited releases, so... the first is The Post. It stars Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, Alison Brie, and a cast of thousands. It's a great big Oscar-looking movie by Steven Spielberg, and it is the true story of Katharine Graham, the first female publisher of a major American paper, The Washington Post, and how it published the Pentagon Papers before Watergate. So Meryl Streep plays Graham, Tom Hanks plays Ben Bradley, and the rest of the cast includes Alison Brie, David Odenkirk, and a whole bunch of other people. It is certainly a timely film, or looks like one anyway, basically telling the tale of the struggle that journalism faced to hold the White House accountable decades ago, and obviously that's a struggle that we can relate to today. I don't know if I'm going to bother seeing this on the big screen, honestly, but I'm sure I will watch it eventually, because, you know, hard to go wrong with Spielberg. The Commuter, on the other hand, stars Liam Neeson, seems to be about a guy who is being blackmailed to stay on a train, do something with a train. He's trapped on a train, in any case. The villain is played by Patrick Wilson, and it doesn't look very good. It looks like the kind of movie that they dump in January. Liam Neeson was in a really good revenge film not too long ago called A Walk Among the Tombstones, based on a novel by Lawrence Block, so you might want to check that out instead. Third new release this weekend is Proud Mary, stars Taraji P. Henson and Danny Glover. It seems to be a picture about a kick-ass female assassin. And actually, I only know that because I looked up a description of the film. The trailer itself doesn't really tell you a whole lot. It's basically just Taraji Henson going around blowing stuff up and looking fierce. And that's fine, of course, but it doesn't really give you a whole lot of clues as to what the story is, which, I don't know, I feel like that's something trailers ought to do sometimes. So the marketing isn't really doing it a lot of favors, I don't think. The poster makes it look like it's some kind of retro Pam Grier film. The trailer is just humorless action over a Tina Turner version of the title song, Proud Mary. Yeah, so what's happening? Who are these people? What are they doing? I'll find out eventually on Netflix, I guess, as the trailer doesn't really compel me to go see it before that. Paddington 2, on the other hand, I remember seeing the original, or the first Paddington movie. It was a very pleasant surprise. It was very well done, very cute, very funny. Kid-friendly, obviously. I'm sure this one will be the same. It stars Ben Whishaw, Julie Walters, Jim Broadbent, based on the beloved British book series. And... without having seen it, I feel fairly confident saying that if you've got young kids up to age 10 or so, I do highly recommend the first, and I would risk it on this new one. Finally, for new releases, we've got a musical called Saturday Church, starring Luca Kane and Regina Taylor. It seems to be about an African-American teenage boy trying to come to terms both with his trans identity and his faith, and it certainly does look good. It's a little tough to make that call with a musical if you haven't seen the show. Obviously, a musical is only going to be as good as its music. If it comes around, I would certainly consider seeing it. Otherwise, I'm sure I will catch it eventually.
Previously, on Sunday Night in Cinema 3.
So this was the first of many rerun weeks. I called them reruns, where they basically played the same movie in Cinema 3 for 2 weeks or more in a row. The first week, it was One Missed Call with Ed Burns. And then the second week, again, One Missed Call with Ed Burns. And At the time, I think I must have suspected that such a thing would happen. I thought I'd be a smarty pants, and I brought my PlayStation Portable, or PSP, as they were known. I brought that with me to the theater, preloaded with a copy of Takashi Miike's original Japanese version of One Missed Call, Chakushin Arari, so that I could play that while the remake played. And I'm not going to bother, you know, going in and dissecting and doing a full review of Chakushin Arari for you now. Suffice to say that it's an okay picture, and the American version turned out not to be a shot-for-shot remake, but it was surprisingly close. I noticed as I watched the original on the PSP, while the big screen remake played out at the same time, the beats were very much the same, the way the scenes were edited was very much the same. And obviously you could do a lot worse as a director than to, you know, basically copy a Takashi Miike film.
Intermission.
This seems like a logical week to talk about remakes. So that's my question for you, the listener. There's obviously lots of remakes every year. I feel fairly confident saying that most of them don't necessarily seem to add a lot of value, or, you know, I don't know if a lot of them are really worth the effort that it takes to make them. There are some that turn out decently, especially in the past few years. There have been what I've been calling pre-makes, where you essentially remake a film, but you also set it so that you position it so that it's like a prequel to what you're remaking, so that it kind of feeds into the remake, into the original. I'm thinking of the recent remake of The Thing, which feeds into the John Carpenter version, which of course was itself a remake. And I liked Prometheus. I know a lot of people didn't for one reason or another, but I did really like it, and I liked how it essentially is a pre-make of the original Alien with a much bigger budget, obviously. And then there are some international remakes that go in the other direction. High School Musical, for example, there is a Chinese version of it, which is very cute. There's a Chinese version of What Women Want, starring Andy Lau. I forget who the female co-star was. The original American version, of course, starred Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt. I'm bad with pulling names from memory sometimes, so I hope that won't happen a whole lot here on the podcast. But anyway, there's a Chinese version of What Women Want, made a fair number of years after the English version. They made it for whatever reason, and since it starred Andy Lau, I'm sure it did very well. What else do I want to talk about in the intermission this week? I want to talk a little bit about just terminology. That is to say, the idea of film criticism versus film reviews. Because I think that these two terms get used interchangeably sometimes, and I'm sure I'm going to be talking about them on and off over the course of the year here on the podcast. So I just want to give you a little bit of insight into how I think of them. So we tend to think of the word criticism as a negative thing. Sometimes we experience critical remarks from others, or we hear someone say that somebody's being critical, meaning that they're always pointing out the shortcomings of things. But for our purposes here, film criticism is just a cousin of critique, an exercise that every art school student will be familiar with. When you show your work to your peers and they offer their comments, and sometimes they can be negative, but hopefully they're meant to be constructive. And in critique, another artist points out what they see as the strengths and weaknesses of the work, and sometimes that helps the artist of the work develop. So a film critic is somebody who's seen a huge number of films, but more importantly, they spend their time thinking about the films that they've seen, not just about their strengths and weaknesses, but also about their impact on the history of cinema, which of course is not something that you can usually predict on the opening weekend of a film. The film reviewer, on the other hand, is doing more of a gut check. They see a film, usually at a special screening in advance of its release. They've got a limited time to write about it, and they essentially have to answer one question afterward. Do they recommend it, and why? Or why not? Their primary job is to steer the movie-going audience in the direction they feel would make the audience happiest or give them the best value for their money. And so, in a very broad sense, they're rewarding what they feel are good films and punishing what they feel are bad films. And there's nothing wrong with this. It's a valuable service, especially now, with so many options and an evening at the movies costing as much as it does. So the way I like to think about it is that the film reviewer answers the question, is this new release worth your time and money? Whereas the film critic tries to answer a series of deeper questions that take place, or that place the film in the context of cinema history. And that's really something, those are questions that you answer after all the opening weekend box office has died down and probably after the DVD release and awards season have all died down. Obviously, critics do write about movies before that. They often write, you know, right around its time of release. But they'll also go back and, as they continue to write about newer films that come out, they may reassess older films that continue to kind of stand head and shoulders above what's come out since. To do all this, they need to know about how films are made and about different international film traditions and the history of popular films from Hollywood itself. A film reviewer and a film critic could very well be the same person. My favorite example of one is the late Roger Ebert, who, of course, everyone from my generation remembers from appearing on television with his Chicago newspaper rival, Gene Siskel, and who, much to his chagrin, cemented the popularity of the kind of gut check, thumbs up, thumbs down system of judging a film. In print, he was a thoughtful and expansive writer who won multiple Pulitzer Prizes for his film reviews, to which he would attach a starred rating in the tradition of the late critic Pauline Kael, who would assign between 0 and 4 stars to a film, 0 obviously signifying a film with no redeeming features whatsoever, and 4 signifying a film that's a classic. It's not meant to be a perfect system, but it is, nonetheless, a system that's been around for decades now. In any case, I don't pretend to be a film critic, professionally or otherwise, but I do love film, and I try to think about it deeply the way that I was trained to think about literature in college. In fact, it was college where I really started to take movies seriously. And you know what? I think I'll leave it at that. I'll talk a bit more about my origin story, such as it is, of being a movie fan next time, and I'll tell you about how I got into film in college, what kind of stuff I was watching, and some more reminiscences of that in the next episode, in the next intermission.
And now, our feature presentation.
Out of my personal DVD collection this week is Infernal Affairs, directed by Andrew Lau. It was a huge, huge hit in Asia when it was released, I believe in 2002, and starred many of the biggest Asian stars of the day, including Tony Leung and Andy Lau, as well as, who else? There was Anthony Wong and Eric... I'm going to pronounce a lot of names wrong here, I'm sorry. Eric Song, I believe, is his name. Chapman Toe and Kelly Chen and all kinds of other people that I'm forgetting, I'm sorry. In any case, huge, huge movie. It won a bunch of awards the year that it came out in Asia. It served as the inspiration for a very well-regarded American remake called The Departed with Leonardo DiCaprio, directed by Martin Scorsese, I believe. And that was also a very good film. But the original, I think what's most remarkable about the original is just the fact that it is such a huge kind of Hollywood-style production at a time when, in the Hong Kong film industry, I should preface all this by saying I have literally watched hundreds of movies from Hong Kong. I started in the early to mid-90s. I was living in Ontario at the time. And as part of their cable system up there, because of the huge immigrant population, there are a couple of TV stations, well, more than a couple now, I'm sure, but at the time, a couple that showed nothing but international programming in different languages. And every Saturday night, they would have a movie night where they would show a movie from... a Cantonese language movie from the Hong Kong film industry. And I loved those movies. At first I watched them just, you know, because they were foreign films and, you know, full of, you know, all these beautiful people and they're kind of action packed, but also very low budget. And they made these movies very quickly and just kind of cranked them out with a lot of the same stars starring in the same types of movies again and again. But by the time Infernal Affairs rolled around, there had been a few big changes in the Hong Kong film industry just in the decade or so that I had been watching up to that point. And of course, the biggest of all was the return of Hong Kong to Chinese rule in 1997. Before that, of course, for 100 years, it had basically been leased to the British for the purposes of trade with China. Hong Kong was kind of a buffer zone. And so there was a very big British influence there, a lot of people who speak English, and a much more westernized attitude than on mainland China. So there's a lot of crossfade back and forth between British and Chinese culture in Hong Kong particularly. So Andrew Lau, the director of Infernal Affairs, and also the co-writer, he had been working as a cinematographer for a great Chinese director named Wong Kar-wai, who the star Tony Leung had also worked with a number of times. And Tony himself was kind of a breakout star. Of course I didn't have it in my notes, but I don't remember if he had made some of the films yet that would gain him. He kind of became known as an international sex symbol because of movies like In the Mood for Love. He had also gained a lot of international acclaim and attention. In any case, Infernal Affairs, if you've seen The Departed, the story's very much the same. It's the story of two young men, one played by Tony Leung, one played by Andy Lau. They start out together in the police academy, but they're there for very different reasons. And one of them is there, Tony Leung is kind of identified early on by one of the higher-ups in the police force. He's identified as a very strong candidate, strong enough that they basically want to give him a very special assignment. They force him to wash out of the police academy and then switch allegiances to become an undercover agent in the Triads, which of course is the organized crime of Hong Kong. And then on the other side, the Triads send a young man, eventually played by Andy Lau, to do the opposite. He's going to infiltrate the police by going through the police academy, but he's still loyal to the Triads. So you've basically got this kind of parallel but opposite path for these two young men, and they both excel at their assigned tasks. The Triad does very well in the police academy and is a young rising star in the police force, and Tony Leung becomes a young rising star in the Triads, watched over by Eric Tsang. And he becomes a kind of trusted, not quite right-hand man, but certainly somebody that is in the inner circle of the Triads. And so the movie is just ingenious, the way that it swaps back and forth between the two sides, and how especially how Tony Leung wants to, he's been a Triad for 3 years by the time we join them as adults, basically. He's telling Anthony Wong, his handler, that he wants to get out of it. Anthony Wong asks him to put up with it just for a little longer so that they can try to land Eric Song's organization and throw him in jail. They have a confrontation early on where the police are going to raid a drug deal that Eric Song has organized. Andy Lau, as the Triad mole, is secretly warning him through a series of what appears to be kind of Morse code tapping over the phone. And so Eric Song manages to avoid getting arrested. But because of all the information flowing back and forth, both sides, basically confront each other and say, we know you've got a mole, we're going to find who they are. And so the middle part of the movie is basically Andy Lau as the rising, the up-and-coming cop who is actually a Triad, actually gets promoted to internal affairs and is given the assignment to find himself, basically, to find the Triad mole in what is, a very Phil Dickian turn of fortunes there. Meanwhile, Tony Leung, the cop who is embedded in the Triads, wants to get out of there either before he's killed or discovered. And to make his situation worse, he actually runs into an old girlfriend at one point it becomes clear that his old girlfriend has a daughter who is a daughter he doesn't know about, but it's his. And but maybe he suspects, and in any case, he has one more reason to want to get free of his assignment. So whether if you've seen The Departure, then or the Departed, then you already know this. There's a lot of great kind of back and forth set pieces where the tension just keeps winding up and up and up, like you're, you know, on a, being stretched on a rack and they're just turning that wheel. It's remarkable, really, especially in a Hong Kong movie from 2002. Like, they were clearly paying attention to some of the bigger action hits of the Western filmmaking tradition. They spent a lot of money on the stars. They spent a lot of money on music. The music and the composing in this film is very remarkable, very strong. Just the filming techniques, the stock they used, the camera, the gear, the cameras they used, everything seems to be much higher level than what you usually would get from a Hong Kong picture at that time. They wanted it to be a real prestige property, clearly, and they succeeded. They succeeded in every way. It was a huge hit domestically. The remake was a huge hit abroad. The soundtrack was a huge hit. It was just a monster of an award-winning film in Asia. There were two sequels, maybe more. I don't know. I know that I've seen one of them, but I don't think I ever saw the second. And you can buy them all on DVD as a set. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. Infernal Affairs. Just a splendid cast, especially if you like, you know, Martin Scorsese style films. Even if you don't, if you just want a really satisfying, suspenseful action picture, you can't go wrong. Infernal Affairs, great stuff. Do check it out. It's also worth mentioning, by the way, Tony Leung and Andy Lau also have huge, or did have, I don't know if they still do, they have huge careers as recording artists in China. And so they actually collaborated on a song that they sing together over the credits of Infernal Affairs. And that song was also a huge hit. So just a funny little bit of trivia for you there. It's hard to imagine that happening in very many American films. Like, I can't really picture Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston singing over the credits of a Thor movie, but maybe. Actually, maybe I can picture that. But anyway. Good times.
Roll the credits.
Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is produced, written, and recorded by Scott Marshall. That's me. With much appreciated help from Nicole Slip and the nice people at the Central Branch of the Halifax Public Library. Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is copyright 2018 by Scott Marshall. All rights reserved. Please send your feedback, questions, or concerns to Sunday Night in Cinema 3, that's the number 3, not the written out word 3, at gmail.com or through social media. Visit SundayNightInCinema3.com for our links to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and whatever other platforms I can stand to deal with. This podcast does not have any advertisements, because I figure we all have enough advertising in our lives, but it does have some modest expenses. So if you'd like to support the podcast, you can check out my Patreon at patreon.com/ScottMarshall. That's 2 T's, 2 L's. For as low as $1 a month, you will have exclusive benefits, including outtakes and bonus material from the podcast, a heads up on what's coming up from me, and access to other exclusive digital content that I haven't even thought of yet. The Patreon also has a community forum where you can talk to each other or ask me questions, and if you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you'll receive regular packages from me in the mail of exclusive stuff, including comics, art prints, stickers, game prototypes, and whatever else I can think of. Whatever you do, thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. See you next Sunday in Cinema 3.
Good night.